Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio, your intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. My name is Fred Flights. I'm substituting for your usual host, Frank Gaffney, who is on a much-earned vacation this week. I am a senior vice president with the Center for Security Policy, a former CIA analyst, and I have three extraordinary guests for you today. But I first want to talk about something extraordinary that happened on Friday. This was a press conference held by Attorney General Sessions and Director of National Intelligence Coates on this serious problem of leaks we are seeing in the Trump administration. They announced a major crackdown on people who were leaking national security information. And this is something I think was long overdue. This is an issue that's very close to my heart as a former CIA analyst. And I think it's just worth noting the enormous damage that leaks like this can cause. When intelligence is leaked to the news media, lives can be lost. Intelligence programs that cost hundreds of millions of dollars to develop can be rendered useless. And then we know our friends and allies are not going to share information, sensitive intelligence, maybe on terrorism, with this country if they know it's going to appear in the New York Times. And this also goes for the president's confidential discussions with foreign leaders. You may have seen recently how the Washington Post published transcripts of discussions that the president had with two foreign leaders. Now, we knew about this from January. This had been leaked earlier. The transcripts actually were only leaked a few days ago. This is just intolerable. How can the president conduct foreign policy if he can't speak candidly to foreign leaders? Well, I think there's been some steps taken to address this. You'll notice that there haven't been reports of the confidential discussions of the president's discussions with foreign leaders since the beginning of this administration. I think the reason is because steps were taken to basically exclude all the hangers-on who usually would listen into these calls, and the transcripts were held very tightly. But this really is something that shouldn't be going on. It shows a lack of respect for this president by careers in the government, probably by Obama administration holdovers. And it really reflects, I think, the incredible hostility to this president by the news media to damage Mr. Trump using any means possible. These individuals who leak classified information, they're not whistleblowers, they're traitors. They're committing felonies. They are narcissists. They are people who have decided to put politics ahead of the oath they took to protect national security information. These people sign multiple documents where they give their word that they will not compromise this information. What I thought was very significant of what Director of National Intelligence Coates said on Friday, he noted that there are multiple legitimate avenues that intelligence whistleblowers can use if they have a classified concern, other than going to the news media, which is never acceptable. He said, well, if you're uncomfortable going to your management or your inspector general, you can go to Congress. You can go to your member of Congress. You can go to the intelligence oversight committees. Now, I've been saying this for a long time. I've written about this in National Review Online, that Congress should be a safe haven for intelligence whistleblowers. So traitors like Edward Snowden, if they have some type of classified concern, and I don't think Snowden really did, they can go to Congress and they can act on it. Think about what would have happened if Snowden had brought his concerns about NSA abuses to Senator Ron Wyden. Wyden was sympathetic to some of the things that Snowden said. Snowden easily could have gone to Wyden. He could have went to one of Wyden's aides. And I know this because I was a staffer on the House Intelligence Committee staff. And I saw this frequently. People from the intelligence community would come to the staff or they would come to members to raise concerns with them that they thought that Congress needed to know about. That's the correct approach. Members of the intelligence committees and the staff, they have high-level clearances. They can receive this kind of information. I don't know until this time why intelligence officials have sort of played down the option of going to the Hill. But I'm glad Coates made a change and he made it explicit that this is a legitimate avenue. And I think this could serve maybe as a safety valve for legitimate whistleblowers and maybe disgruntled individuals who simply can't help themselves, but we can stop them from wrecking classified information by leaking it to the news media. There's been some controversy over something that Sessions said, that there will be investigations of journalists. I think Sessions is raising the point that freedom of the speech, I think he said, is not unlimited. And what he means there is that this is almost like how you are not, you may have freedom of the speech, but you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. I've seen instances where the New York Times and other journals have published classified information, such as the names of CIA station chiefs and very sensitive information on WMD programs, simply because they could. It really didn't serve the public interest. They just simply wanted to increase the number of their readers, increase their circulation. I don't know what the solution is in balancing freedom of the press and the damage the media can do to national security if it simply recklessly publishes very sensitive intelligence that could cost lives. But I think this is something we have to talk about. Finally, there's been some talk lately that President Trump is responsible for these leaks because of his criticism and hostility towards the U.S. intelligence community. Let's put that to bed right now. Last summer, you may remember that when Mr. Trump was a candidate, there were numerous times that intelligence officers, current and former, anonymously, of course, said to the news media that if asked, they would refuse to brief Mr. Trump as a candidate. The briefings he got as a candidate were repeatedly leaked to the news media. After he was inaugurated, there was a long series of leaks by intelligence officials. Former CIA Director Brennan was incredibly hostile to Mr. Trump before and after Brennan left office. And remember when former Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid urged intelligence officers to brief candidate Trump fake intelligence, brief him fake intelligence. This, I think, took place last August. So here we have a man who is challenging the Washington system, who was running an insurgency campaign. He sees the top Democrat in the Senate urging intelligence officers to lie to him in their intelligence briefings. Now, I would assume that Mr. Trump and his close advisors, probably his family, wondered whether Senator Reid was speaking for the intelligence community. So when Mr. Trump has criticized intelligence agencies over being biased and politicizing intelligence, which I might add, I've seen personally as a CIA analyst, I think he was on solid ground. Mr. Trump also criticized analysis put forward by the intelligence community on Iraq that proved to be wrong. Well, this is a matter of record. That intelligence was wrong. Now, intelligence is going to be wrong sometimes. We want intelligence to push the envelope. We want analysts to call them the way they see them. We want them to dare to take risks. You know, whether Mr. Trump went too far in criticizing the intelligence community or not, the fact is that that intelligence was wrong. But it's amazing the number of former intelligence officers. All they can see is Trump's criticism, and they have nothing to say about the harsh criticism of him by intelligence officers, by former intelligence officers, criticism that I think really went over the line. So obviously, this doesn't justify leaking classified information. And I will tell you that most intelligence officers are non-political. They're loyal to whoever serves in the White House. They want to keep politics out of their work. I really welcome what Attorney General Sessions and Director of National Intelligence Coates said on Friday, that they're going to crack down on these leakers, that they're going to find them, that they're basically reminding everyone who holds security clearances that they have a duty to this country to protect this information. Well, I'm Fred Flight, substituting for Frank Gaffney on Secure Freedom Radio. My first guest today, who will be up in a moment, is Dr. Gordon Chang. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
My first guest this morning is Gordon Chang. He is a columnist at the Daily Beast, a contributor at Forbes.com, a blogger at World Affairs Journal, and he is frankly one of the smartest guys I know concerning China and the situation with North Korea. Gordon, welcome.
Thank you so much, Fred.
Gordon, we have a lot to talk about. There was a tough resolution passed against North Korea on Saturday, sanctioning it for its missile tests. We've had some action this morning concerning reactions by China, Russia, and North Korea. I want to get your take on it.
The resolutions enacted Saturday indeed are the toughest of the UN's seven set of sanctions, but they're not going to be enough. The real problem here is that we are taking an incremental approach, and the North Koreans are able to adjust. So every time there's a new set of sanctions, they figure out how to evade them, and then we have a new set, and they evade again. What we really need to do is give them all we got, hit them as hard as we possibly can all at once. That will then force the North Koreans to basically either come to the negotiating table, which is what we want, or indeed stop their missile program because they have no choice.
I'm curious what you think about China's reaction to the sanctions. Now, China agreed to these sanctions. They've agreed to sanctions in the past, but they've also said that they're the first step to negotiations, and their official media has said not to exaggerate their significance. What is China's game here?
Well, I think China realizes that these sanctions will not affect North Korean behavior, which is the reason why they accepted them. China actually got a lot from this. And the reason is that President Trump was all set on Friday to announce an investigation under Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974. We were going to look at China's predatory intellectual property rules. However, on Thursday afternoon, both the State Department and UN officials contacted the White House and persuaded them to hold off on the announcement. This is an issue where we're going to have to deal with on trade because of what China is doing to really the heart of the American economy. But nonetheless, the Chinese got a lot, and they didn't give up very much because they know that, first of all, these sanctions won't affect the North Koreans in the long run, and also the Chinese are not going to enforce them. So this is a real win for Beijing across the board.
I think those are good points. For example, there was a supposedly tough sanction passed against North Korea last September, and then North Korea's trade with China expanded by 37% in the first quarter of this year. And I note in the current sanctions, future North Korean workers sent abroad are banned, but current workers in China and Russia don't have to be sent back, and there's no oil embargo. So I think you're right. Do you think there's a chance we could somehow get these concessions in a future sanctions resolution if North Korea doesn't comply?
Yeah, I'm sure there's going to be an eighth set of sanctions, a ninth set of sanctions, a tenth, et cetera. The problem, though, is that within a year or so, the North Koreans will be able to put a nuke on a missile that will be able to reach the American homeland. So we're running out of time. And that means what we can do, I mean, I think sanctions will be effective if, for instance, they incorporate an embargo. Also, sanctions should be applied to the Chinese because of their busting of sanctions and as well their money laundering for the North Koreans. The Trump administration, to its credit, severed a small fry Chinese institution, the Bank of Dandong, from the global banking system on June 29th for money laundering. But we got to remember that Bank of China, one of China's so-called big four banks, was also named in a 2016 UN report for devising and operating a money laundering scheme for the North Koreans. And Bank of China, you know, does business in the U.S. uninterrupted, unimpeded. We don't fine Bank of China. We don't sever it from the global banking system. These are things that we need to consider doing because we just don't have that many months before the North Koreans can threaten us.
I think that's exactly right. I also note that the new sanctions resolution doesn't have any measure against Chinese firms or Chinese investment. Concerning resuming nuclear talks with North Korea, Secretary Tillerson has said that the United States will not consider returning to the negotiating table until North Korea stops missile tests. And he thinks there should be an extended pause. And he says he's not talking about 1 month. What's your view on this?
Well, I think the most important thing is eventually we will talk to the North Koreans, but we should only talk to them when they realize that they have no choice but to disarm. Talking to them beforehand is counterproductive. It gives them even more time to perfect their arsenals. So, you know, I would have phrased it entirely differently. The North Koreans, as Secretary Tillerson said 2 or 3 days ago, you know, have to realize and have to accept the process of denuclearization. So what Tillerson said about a pause on missile tests really is a climb down. We shouldn't be climbing down right now. We should be climbing up because, you know, this is time is a factor. And, you know, in the past, we had perhaps the luxury of engaging in pointless diplomacy, but not now.
No, I think that's exactly right. And there's actually reports recently that North Korea could be 1 to 2 years away from developing an H-bomb. Do you find those reports credible?
Probably not. I don't think the North Koreans can do that unless they have even more help from the Chinese. And I don't think the Chinese would actually go to that extent. But, you know, while and this is another point, but it's also at the same time we have to take action against China because the missiles that North Korea fired on July 4th and July 28th, their intercontinental ballistic missiles, were carried to the launch sites by Chinese transporter erectors. And indeed, North Korea's most sophisticated missiles, more sophisticated than the ones that they tested last month, they look to be variants of China's JL-1 submarine launch missile. Now, I can't say that the Chinese gave them the technology, but we're not even asking the questions of the Chinese about how come the North Koreans have missiles that look to be Chinese.
I think that's exactly right. Now, what about military options? No one wants to talk about U.S. military strikes against North Korea, but if we were to consider some measured military responses, what do you think should be considered?
Well, striking North Korea's launch sites that we know of. Also, we should be striking Yongbin, where they have their nuclear facilities. But I actually don't think that we have to do that yet. If we were to do limited surgical strikes on North Korea's weapon sites, I don't think the North Koreans would retaliate. But on the other hand, the consequences of North Korean retaliation are so horrific that we really should be trying all of our non-kinetic options. We have so many. They just require political will. Now, neither party, Republicans, conservatives, Democrats, liberals, nobody has had the political will to do what is necessary to stop the North Koreans. And this is a case of bipartisan failure over the course of decades. So I think that because the military options are so horrible, we have a moral obligation, not just to ourselves and to the South Koreans and the Japanese, but really to everybody, to try everything possible short of the use of force. We may get to the point where we have to use force, but let's do all the other things first.
How about shooting down North Korean missiles? Are we coming to the point where we should be considering doing that?
I think that we should consider it. But on the other hand, the thing that I'm concerned about is that we then change the nature of the global narrative to not the North Koreans testing missiles, but what will be portrayed by the Chinese, Russians, and others as American arrogance and American aggressiveness. Also, we find out a lot about North Korea's missiles while they're in the air. So if they are not headed towards Japanese territory or American territory, I would sort of hold off on that option, especially since if we fired and we missed, that would be a big green light for the North Koreans. So at this time, I'm concerned about that. But as I said, we have so many other non-kinetic options we haven't tried yet, and we should be doing these things, even though they're hard.
Well, Gordon Chang, thank you so much for joining me today. Please check out The Daily Beast, Forbes.com, World Affairs Journal. You'll also see him frequently on CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News. Gordon, thanks for being with me today.
Thank you so much, Fred.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. This is Fred Flights filling in for Frank Gaffney on Secure Freedom Radio. Our next guest is Matthew Brodsky. He is a senior fellow with the Security Studies Group, a senior analyst in Wikistrat's analytic community, and the former director of policy for the Jewish Policy Center for Security Policy. Matthew, welcome.
Good to be with you.
You've written some interesting articles recently that I wanted to discuss with you. The first one concerning the situation in Qatar, and this concerns a piece you published in National Review on August 3rd, titled Qatar's Dirty Hands. Could you give us a review of the situation with Qatar and what the United States should be doing about it?
Well, Qatar has definitely been involved in supporting all forms of terrorism and Islamism. Basically, they have their hands in all pieces of the pie, so we say, in the region, as compared to, say, Saudi Arabia or the UAE. And that goes with their support on the Sunni side of the ledger with Hamas, with Al-Qaeda, with the Taliban, too, even their cozy relationship with Iran. They're have also been working against what the region would like in Libya for a long time, providing billions of dollars in military material to keep that civil war going because of their support, along with Turkey, the Muslim Brotherhood. And so the whole situation, initially it seemed as though part of the administration, that being mostly the State Department in the U.S., wanted to kind of brush the whole conflict under the carpet and just move on so that there could be a united front against Iran. But you can see that that the motivating factor for the Gulf region right now and for America's traditional allies is that they see Qatar's support for this bad behavior is really what is motivating them now more than Iran. And the United States should be trying to bring about a substantive change in Qatar's behavior, not just a cosmetic one.
What role is Qatar playing in Syria, and what should the U.S. be doing about this?
Well, in part, what you will hear, and to an extent it is true, that the Obama administration dithered in Syria for so long that those who wanted to see Assad go decided that they were going to support other elements of the rebellion. But Qatar chose to do this with the Jabhat al-Nusra, or the al-Nusra Front, and al-Qaeda affiliates. And this is really where they have thrown their support. So literally, they made what was initially not an Islamist revolution. It wasn't about bringing a greater role of Islam into Syria when the whole uprising began in 2011. But it was certainly hijacked since then. And there's no way that we could have gotten to this point today where it's as Islamist as, so we say, the heat is as intense, without Qatar's support for the worst of the jihadist elements inside Syria. And that still continues to this day with their support for HTS, the Hayat al-Sham in Syria.
This is Fred Flights with Secure Freedom Radio. My guest today is Matthew Brodsky, senior fellow with the Security Studies Group. Well, Matthew, I'd also like to talk to you about some recent developments concerning the nuclear deal with Iran. You wrote a very persuasive article recently in the Jerusalem Post entitled, A State Department Gone Rogue on Iran. Now, there are many on the conservative side of Washington who have similar concerns. Where do you come down on this situation?
Well, the thing, if the president is going to ask for options on what he can do, especially when it comes to recertifying Iran every 3 months, as he needs to do to Congress, then that is what the State Department should be doing. And that's what Tillerson should be doing as Secretary of State. But he's not done that in April, and he hasn't, and he didn't do that again in July. Now, the next time this comes up in October, and in the meantime, there's another issue, which is the circular firing squad in the White House and in the NSC. Now, they're the ones who were tasked in April, once the White House argued with the State Department to come up with more acceptable language to recertify Iran, it called for an NSC-led process to review the JCPOA, or the Iran deal, and to also review Iran policy as a whole. Well, now they're purging a lot of the Iran hawks from the NSC. That review isn't done. So on one hand, you have the State Department not following through with what it's supposed to, according to Trump's orders on recertification. And on the other hand, there's not a plan that's in place from a process that's been led by the NSC, which is, again, has to be delayed again, because of the circular firing squad. So I would say in the end that in multiple areas, the president is not being well served by many of those around him.
Well, there are recent arguments that have been rolled out by defenders of the Iran deal, I regret, from the administration, that Iran is in technical compliance. And when they violate the agreement, we can always go to the IAEA for remediation. What are your responses to these claims?
Right. The new plan that's being floated for the United States to request more inspections is really a trap to tie the administration's hands for years in an international process that will gain nothing. The fact is the deal was broken the day it was signed. There is no mulligan. That's number one. Number two, there's also a fashionable idea that you can apply some pressure and renegotiate the deal. Go back and see number one. It was a broken deal beforehand. You can't renegotiate it. There's no mulligan. We're stuck with the deal unless we get rid of the deal. Now, there are arguments on you can get rid of the deal by simply saying we're done with it, or giving it to Congress and saying this should be a treaty and then it would never get that support. Or you can push back on Iran cheating, saying that they're cheating, push back with sanctions inside the deal, and also push back, which we're not doing enough of outside of the deal, in human rights and terrorism and ballistic missiles, and then get Iran to ditch the deal themselves. That's also a good option. But right now, we're not in a position where we're where we're pursuing either, I would say, in a manner that is strong enough that Trump himself would like.
So if we pull out of the agreement, what should our strategy be? What should our post-JCPOA strategy be?
You see, here's the catch-22, because ideally, even if you stayed in the deal and pushed back within it, or you got rid of the deal, what you need is a functioning State Department that's working with allies, number one, to agree that there's going to be a certain response and to lay the groundwork. So what we would need to do, essentially, we need to be prepared for Iran making a decision that they're going to try to break out and race to create a nuclear weapon, in which case all bets are off. But that is something that we need to be able to do and be prepared for, and that the United States military has to have a plan ready the moment that happens. I myself, I'm not entirely sure to what extent that plan exists. If it is, that would certainly be a very good thing. But we have to be prepared for that contingency. So we need to put as many penalties as we can, but we need all the arms of the government to be functioning, I would say, first, in order to make the most of it, because this could be it could very quickly escalate. Literally, what happens is if the Trump administration doesn't recertify Iran, then it goes over to Congress, and then Congress has 60 days to decide whether they're going to ditch the entire deal and put back the secondary sanctions against Iran, or whether they're just going to put together a certain level of sanctions against Iran. So there is some built-in time, but you know, time is ticking. We're 200 days into the administration, and we really need the people around President Trump to be functioning and working toward the same goal and not engaged in a tug of war over policy.
Well, Matthew Bratsky, I'm afraid we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining me today. If you want to see his excellent work on Qatar and the Iran deal, please check out National View Online and his July 24th piece with the Jerusalem Post. Thanks for being with us. I'm Fred Plaits.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. This is Fred Flights substituting for Frank Gaffney on Secure Freedom Radio. Our next guest is a good friend of mine, Dr. Peter Pry, a fellow former CIA analyst. He also is executive director of the Task Force on National Homeland Security, director of the U.S. Nuclear Security Forum, a member of the Congressional EMP Commission. He is really one of the smartest guys I know when it concerns the threat from electromagnetic pulse. So I think he's going to have some very important comments for us today. Peter, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Fred.
Peter, you wrote an extraordinary article recently titled North Korea and Iran Are Equal Threats. Could you explain what that article was about?
Sure. I thought that the recent North Korean tests on July 4th and July 28th, their successful tests at ICBM, you know, really exposed how the intelligence community has been grossly underestimating the threat from North Korea, and therefore we shouldn't be trusting their estimates on Iran. It's great that I'm being interviewed by you, Fred, as a former member of the intelligence community and a person who served on the Senate intelligence staff. You don't have the deference to the intelligence community that most people usually have. They envision them as being infallible, and they're just like the way they're portrayed in the movies. And they're sort of sacred, sacrosanct, and you can't criticize the intelligence community, which is a huge mistake. You and I both know that they're just a corporation, like any corporation, and made up of people who can also have political biases, as they have been politically biased over the years, of 8 years of the Obama administration. And the first lesson I drew from the tests was how they, in effect, admitted they were grossly in error about the North Korean ICBM capability in a report they delivered to Congress last Wednesday. Up until the July 4th point, people basically were arguing, oh, they can't hit the United States, the mainland United States yet. Their ICBM can only reach Alaska and Hawaii, and that was what was being reported on the television. But then in their new estimate, after the July 4th test, they concluded, well, it can hit the west coast of states, and not only that, but they might be able to have a reliable ICBM as early as next year, which shaved 2 to 4 years off their estimate of when we would face the ICBM threat from North Korea, 2 to 4 years, plus now the thing could hit the west coast of the United States. And that estimate didn't survive contact with reality for 48 hours. 2 days later, on July 28th, North Korea launched its next ICBM successfully, which demonstrated even greater capabilities. And then they had to increase the estimate that, well, the ICBM can now reach Denver or as far as Chicago. They had no way of denying that because they demonstrated that kind of range. And some analysts are even talking about North Korea fielding a reliable ICBM this year. So in 48 hours, they dramatically changed the estimate. And even that estimate is probably underestimating the North Korean threat. You know, the July 28th ICBM flew for 45 to 47 minutes. You know, ICBMs based in Central Asia and Russia can strike any part of the United States with a 30-minute flight time. So, and there are independent analysts who assess that the North Korean ICBM can strike as far as Miami, which means it could cover the whole United States. And I believe those independent estimates. I think that that is correct. I think basically Kim Jong-un is telling the truth when he says his ICBM can strike any part of America now. And it's a sad state of affairs and a dangerous state of affairs when the dictator of North Korea is providing more reliable and accurate information than the U.S. intelligence community, the academics, and the national press. But that's where we are. Now, what does this have to do with Iran? Well, just think about the difficulty of the Iranian nuclear target. You know, most of its facilities are underground. We have, there's all kinds of indications that we don't know where all of their nuclear program is located. You know, we know about some of it. We also know in terms of the history that the intelligence community, our intelligence community, didn't even know about the existence of the Iranian nuclear program until it was revealed to us in 2002 by Iranian dissidents. In other words, Iran had successfully hidden its program from our intelligence community for many years before it was revealed to us by dissidents. Now we pretend like we know where the whole the intelligence community acts as if it knows where all of the facilities are, because they are giving reassurances during the Obama administration. They, in effect, were reassuring Congress and the public through the Obama administration, but we know they didn't have the bomb yet. And that, but we did know that they were very close to it. Some estimates were within 6 months of getting the bomb. But we knew for a fact that they didn't have the bomb yet. Therefore, the Iran nuclear deal should go forward to delay and stop Iran from getting a bomb. Now, that's an incredible intelligence capability to be able to be so cocksure that you understand the Iranian nuclear program well enough that they can be within 6 months to a year of the bomb, but you know for a fact they don't have it yet. And they supposedly were within 6 months to a year of the bomb for many years. And this is a program that's hidden underground. We don't have direct access to it. And unlike the North Korean ICBM program, the North Korean ICBMs are exposed to our most sophisticated national technical means, and they still didn't get it right.
Let me ask you a question concerning something that's not being talked about, and that's EMP, because you're an expert on this. Let's talk about EMP, miniaturized nuclear warheads, and how this might be exploited by North Korea's efforts to develop submarine launch missiles.
Not only submarine launch missiles, but the satellites that currently orbit over us. The EMP Commission, on which I serve now as chief of staff, you know, has been warning since 2004 that North Korea has probably got what we call super EMP weapons. These are nuclear weapons of special design. They're designed not to make a big explosion. They're designed to make gamma rays. And they can be very small and lightweight. They could resemble the neutron bomb or the neutron artillery shell that we had deployed in NATO Europe during the 1980s. It's not a technology that's hard to build. The neutron artillery shell was very lightweight. I actually held one in my hands. And it's small enough and light enough that it could fit on one of those North Korean satellites that's passing over us at the optimum altitude to put an EMP field down over the whole 48 contiguous United States, by the way. Now they've got two satellites like that orbiting over us. They could be launched out of sub-launch ballistic missile, you know, or off the deck of a freighter. If you had a ballistic missile hidden in the hold of a freighter, like the Nodong could fit inside of a freighter, and you could launch it against the United States that way offshore and keep it, make the attack anonymous. Or you could launch it long range from an ICBM. In addition to being able to take out the whole country versus just blasting a city, because what the EMP does, it basically creates an electromagnetic field. It's like a super energetic radio wave that has got so much energy in it that it would destroy electronics across an entire continent, black out the electric grid, make cars stop, airplanes crash from the skies, natural gas pipelines would explode, you'd get firestorms, cities, things of that sort. There'd be no food and water.
Well, Peter, I'm afraid we're running out of time, but Dr. Peter Pry, thank you for joining me this morning on Secure Freedom Radio. I'm Fred Flight, substituting for Frank Gaffney. If you would like to read Dr. Pry's fascinating piece on this issue, you can check it out at Newsmax.com, August 4th, 2017. Title is Trump Must Understand Iran and North Korea Are Equal Threats. Thank you for listening. I'm Fred Flights.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.